It's called Harmonic Wars, Guardians of the Crystal Skulls. Lots to talk about, including the pyramids, the story of good versus evil. Douglas D.B. Stearns joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Doug Stearns, our special guest. Doug is a retired U.S. Air Force veteran. Thanks for serving, Douglas, who, after a very successful career in the IT industry, became what was called a happy nester. And he's now a full-time sci-fi writer, independent researcher, loves archaeology, open to the possibilities that maybe this society is not the most advanced society that has lived on this planet. Doug, welcome to the program. I take your beliefs. I agree with you on that.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. And very happy to be on your program today.
I have long since believed that there were other civilizations on our planet with high technology, and then something catastrophic happened to them. How did you get to that conclusion yourself?
Well, like you said, we were happy nesters, and my wife and I decided that we were going to try a different approach, which was to move to like sci-fi writing. And one of the things that inspired me was the Great Pyramid of Giza. I was watching a special on that, and I was just blown away by the advanced technology of the Great Pyramid. There's just so much there that it flies in the face of common knowledge. You know, it's hard for me to believe that 100,000 people would work together for 22 years, cutting, transporting, and placing a block of stone every 2 minutes with laser precision, and create this hole in the ground basically to put a dead guy in.
If I were a pharaoh, I'd want this done like immediately, and it never happened that way.
No, it takes a long time, and at some point in time, you look back and say, why am I doing this? The historians and the Egyptologists will look back and they say, well, they used copper chisels to hammer out all of this stuff, and it just blows your mind that they would do something like that. I look at using copper chisels on granite as the same thing as using a plastic knife to cut down a redwood tree.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you could probably do it, and it would take a lot of time and a lot of effort. And there are those who will still say, never underestimate, the will, the human power, and I just can't believe that. When it comes down to it, I would wonder how many times and how many blocks of granite that they would cut before they would stop and say, okay, look, there's got to be an easier way to do this.
And what baffles me, Doug, is what happened to the technology once they had it? I mean, where did it go?
You know, that's the main thing that really blows my mind, too. The Great Pyramid of Giza was supposedly 4,500 years ago built by the Fourth Dynasty. And they had what would have been the pinnacle of their building technology, the Great Pyramid. And then everything after that was greatly diminished. You know, even the other two pyramids there are, heads above the rest, but they pale in comparison to the perfection of the Great Pyramid itself.
True.
And why would you be able to create this perfect building, this perfect structure, and then not be able to replicate it the very next structure that you build?
Well, and it's not just the pyramids, as you know, investigating all these possible structures all around this planet. They're everywhere. Things are everywhere that are unexplainable.
Yes. Absolutely, and that was the approach that I took, was to look at out of the box, completely out of the box, and see just how far it was going to take me. And when I started looking at different buildings and structures around the world that use the same kind of structure technique, the building techniques, and the building materials, that's when I was just totally blown away. And I knew at that point that at one point there was at least one civilization that was highly advanced that lived on a global scale. Because you can see it in Bolivia, in Peru, in Cusco, all of these different places in South America, and you go to India and Indonesia and China, and the tie that binds them all is the fact that they used a high quartz content stone. And that's where things started really getting interesting for me, because stone that has a high quartz content chimes like a bell if you can tap it.
And you have to find that stone, don't you? It doesn't come readily available.
No, it doesn't. But there's a lot of qualities with quartz that links back to electronics. I mean, we use it today in modern electronics. You use it today in, as, you know, quartz timepieces, because quartz has a very consistent frequency that it emits.
It's got a resonance about it.
Yes, it's got a resonance. And harmonic resonance is a common theme throughout my book. And I just kept using that because, you know, you see all of these quartz, high quartz crystals in the stonework of Stonehenge, Karnak, Göbekli Tepe, Pumapunku. And the engineering that was required on the ruins there at Pumapunku, whatever that structure was, make the Great Pyramid of Giza look like child's play.
It sure does. Our guest is Doug Stearns. His book, Harmonic Wars, Guardians of the Crystal Skulls, Aliens and Creationism. An extreme argument. People, if you believe the Zechariah Sitchin theory, Doug, it's of course that extraterrestrials came here, genetically altered the creatures that were on this planet. Here we are, but that they used us for slave labor. And then, of course, you have the Darwinists, the evolutionists. Where do we fit?
Well, if you ask my personal opinion, all you have to do is look in Genesis, and that's what I believe. And that's probably going to make a lot of the listeners a little uneasy with me. But I don't have a problem with my thoughts on this civilization. I have more of a problem believing that, you know, aliens did all of the things in the past and that humanity didn't. When you look today at just how far we've come in the last 50 years, look how far we've advanced. We went from a society that had black and white TVs, you know, not uncommon, but certainly not in every home, you know, 50 years ago.
Right. To getting to the moon.
Not only that, but we've got handheld technology with smartphones that far exceeds what the capabilities of the room full of computers did in the early 60s.
That's true. That's right.
Okay, so we advanced that much in just 50 years now, and you're telling me that in the last 12,000 years, we've never been at this level before. That part I have more of a trouble believing. Now, if there were aliens that came here and, you know, helped us or colonized or whatever, I'm willing to accept that as a possibility. But I'm also willing to accept the possibility that humans were much more advanced in our past. And I think that is more of a problem for a lot of historians. And that's just out of arrogance.
Now, let's go back to the book of Genesis. Is it subject to interpretation? I mean, how do you interpret that?
Well, I don't pretend that I understand how the Almighty created everything. That would be arrogant on my part. But I can look at that and say, well, is this earth the biblical earth? And in for my book, this is not biblical Earth.
That's a good question. They could be talking about a different planet, couldn't they?
Exactly. When you look out there in the sky now, we see all these billions and billions of stars, and some of those points that we view as stars are galaxies, you know, additional galaxies. And there's billions and billions of galaxies that we can't see, you know, not without the naked eye. We got to, you know, hone in the Hubble telescope or, you know, some of the other ones, and focus on a small area for a very, very long period of time until we see multiple galaxies out there across the vast expanse of space. It would be extremely arrogant for me to believe that we're the only sentient life. And there's nothing in the Bible that I've seen that says God didn't create life elsewhere. So for my book, this is not biblical Earth. This is a colony.
That's an interesting take.
Thank you.
It's an interesting
take. And I kind of like to think outside of the box as far as that kind of thing goes. So for some, that's going to be way too far out of the box, but, you know.
Well, you know, you're not alone, Doug. There are a lot of people who would agree with you wholeheartedly over these things.
I appreciate that. And I hope they would enjoy looking at the book. Just to reiterate the point, it is a science fiction book. It's not going to be part of your reference library from a science.
Are you basing it, though, on some fact?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's based on a lot of fact. I did about a year of research before I even started writing any of the story down. And I was wanting to go to Egypt. And when I started doing the research and stuff is when the Arab Spring started kicking off big time. So I figured it'd be safer to stick my nose in the books.
Yeah. Now, you talk about a multidimensional war for control of the universe. What the heck is going on there?
That sounds like I got a lot of static going on.
Yeah, can you hear that?
Yeah.
Okay, we might have to do a little phone switch with you. Are you on a portable?
No, sir. I'm on a landline here. There
okay.
we go.
Yep, it's back. Scratchy, scratchy. But keep going. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay. For my book, I wanted to add some depth to the story. And so I could see where there would be multiple dimensions, thousands of dimensions, and those thousands of dimensions would have life forms in each dimension. And with that in mind, I had to have beings that could cross these dimensions. So I couldn't find a better example of absolute good versus absolute evil than to use angels and demons. So for my book, I have angels and demons that are fighting the battles. And when the battle approaches, you'll have the angels and demons fighting on a parallel dimension right alongside the same battlefield as the humans. But, you know, they don't realize that. They can't see the angels and demons as they fight. So you'll get a perspective of 4, 5, 6 different visions of the same battle in my book.
What do they want?
They want control. And what they're looking for is control of the souls of that dimension. The souls are power for the demons or for the angels.
You have talked about the, you know, highly advanced societies hiding among the current population. How would they do that?
Well, that'd be pretty easy, actually. We've seen
and David Jacobs believes that's happening too. Dr. David Jacobs, who truly believes that their intent is not very friendly, by the way.
Well, I could see where there would be some that are unfriendly and some that are absolutely friendly. And, you know, we've seen examples. If you look up in the moon and you look at Google Moon, you know, Google Earth, Google Mars, and you can see some examples of things that are strange. And, you know, it'd be pretty easy to see that there could have been a civilization there on Mars at one point in time. Some of the things that are shown out there in plain sight in Google Mars, I think are more distractors. The things that they really want us to ignore are the things that are being blurred over. You know, technology doesn't go backwards. So when you have, you know, highly pixelated areas of the moon or Mars, those are the areas I'm really interested in.
But you believe some of these societies, these incredibly high-tech societies, crumble, fall apart. What happens to them?
Well, that's really the easy part. Let's take a look at what would happen today if our society lost total control of all the electricity.
And that could happen, as I've been screaming about. We got to protect our grid.
Exactly. That could very easily happen. All it would take is one well-placed EMP.
Yep.
And the whole grid in the United States would fall. Now, we would bounce back. I think in 5, maybe 10 years, we'd be able to come back from that.
Many would die in between.
It would be pure chaos. All you have to do is go back and look at Hurricane Katrina and, you know, see the massive amounts of looting. And
do this times 100.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, fantastic. But see what happens when you start taking food and water away from people with the capability to do that. And, you know, from a terrorist standpoint, what we've learned in the past is it won't be just one. There'll be multiple. You know, they always attack in multiples. You know, that's what Al-Qaeda does. That's what ISIS is likely to do. And if the whole power grid comes down, period, okay, then everybody goes into a hunter-gatherer survival mode.
But not everybody can. And so those are the ones who die off fast.
Yes. The ones who survive are the ones who are going to be able to work in, you know, in with others that are safe.
Survivalists, people who live on the outdoors, that have learned how to go tenting, those people are going to be okay for a short term.
Yes. But there will be pockets of society which will be able to thrive still. You know, our government, you know, I don't believe for a second that there are not factions within our government that would survive intact exactly the way that they are now.
In their bunkers that are already built, I think.
Yes, absolutely. The uber rich, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, mm-hmm. you know, all of those folks are not going to suffer. They're going to have their cake and eat it too. And they will be able to come back out some point in time. I think that that's what the Great Pyramid was a rebuild of an older technology. And that it was there were pockets of civilization that were able to rebuild and move forward. And when you look at the Great Pyramid of Giza, I kind of agree with Chris Dunn and some of the folks that are like him, that it was a power plant of some sort. And because of the structure and the building components, it resonated, and it created this massive amount of energy. And that energy was put out wirelessly, just like Nikola Tesla had done. It was planning to do with Wardenclyffe. There's so many similarities between the Wardenclyffe Tower and the Great Pyramid of Giza. For example, both were built over an aquifer. That is significant. There are over 100 lightning strikes per second worldwide. And that electricity goes somewhere.
And some of these strikes are huge.
Yes, yes. But that energy doesn't just go away. It's in the earth. It's traveling through the minerals. It's traveling through the water tables. It's traveling. And if you can focus that energy, you can reuse it. Now, it's not a coincidence that the Great Pyramid is built out of high quartz content crystals and stones. I absolutely believe that it was done that way on purpose, and that when it resonates, it puts out this frequency. Well, those of us that are in music understand harmonic resonance. And we know that if you've got a guitar, the top string and the bottom string are both tuned to E. Well, if you hit that open bottom string, the lower E note rather, the top string, the higher E note will resonate on its own.
Hold on, Doug. We're at the break, but we're going to come back and talk more. And then you get involved with good versus evil. And as you said, it's a sci-fi book, but I want to find out how you came to write it. We'll be back. Welcome back with Doug Stearns. We're talking about his work, Harmonic Wars, Guardians of the Crystal Skulls. We'll get into that title in a moment. You could be like the modern-day Leonardo da Vinci, Doug, because you look at special technology, but a lot of it you're predicting based on knowledge, and I like that.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I enjoyed working in the IT industry. We worked on a number of systems for the government, and as a process engineer, I was able to look at things differently as I looked at the building techniques that were used for, like, the Great Pyramid of Giza. And the modern historians and the Egyptologists, their narrative just kind of fell through when I started looking at it from a realistic standpoint. How were these things built? You know, and why would you take a 70-ton piece of granite from 500 miles away, and how would you move it across the desert without any, you know, modern technology? They were talking about, you know, trying to use logs to roll it on, or, you know, thousands of years before the wheel was even invented, and it just doesn't make sense. You wouldn't use logs to transport, you know, these giant stones. And, I mean, where would you have gotten it in the desert? You know, there's no forest there. The only type of wood they would have been able to use would have been from a food source, a fig tree. And, you know, those logs are just not sturdy enough to put granite on. And the other one would have been an olive tree. And still, it's a food source.
And not cold enough to create ice to slide them down into place.
Other one that I like is, we're going to pour out water, and it'll float right across the sand. And, like, desert people are going to, you know, transport millions of gallons of water across the desert. You know, where's the water going to come from? How are they going to get it there? You know, those are the types of things that I'm interested in, and the narrative falls apart very quickly. And that's when I start looking at different types of technology and the focus on sound technology. Now, there's a lot of very fantastic things that they can do with sound. And if we were to focus more on sound technology, I think that we would see a very cool capability to levitate the rock.
How would that work technically? How would sound levitate the rock? Does it turn it into anti-gravity or something? What happens?
Well, we've got examples that we can see, you know, all over the internet where they're already floating materials in the air on sound. They do it with ping pong balls. They do it with small drops of water. And when they change the frequencies, especially in the example of using drops of water, it changes the shape of the water. The problem is we know very little about the actual impact of sound on matter. But there is a whole technology on that, and what they call it cymatic experiments. And you can watch these cymatic experiments and how it affects the different types of matter. For example, I've seen where they take a piece of tin and they'll throw salt down on top of the tin, and then they'll point different frequencies at the tin, and it changes the structure of the salt. The salt will take on a different form, and you can see the different patterns made by the salt, is really what I'm trying to say there. And the higher the frequency, the more complex the dimension, the structure becomes. And it's really cool. The higher the frequency, the more complex it gets, up until the point that the salt is too large to make the intricate patterns. Now, they've done this with water, and it's really cool when they do it. You can see the difference in the shape the water takes as it's floating in the air. And as they add different tones to it, you add a second tone, a third tone, it starts taking on different shapes. It's really cool. One of the things that I think is very suspicious is when we changed from a 432 hertz tuning in our music to 440. Now, when you look at it from a cymatic experiment look, 432 hertz has a very beautiful form to it in water.
Is that like a magical tune?
I'm not quite sure. I just know what it looked like when I saw it on the internet. It was very pretty. And then when it changed just 8 hertz up, it lost all form and function. And you have to start asking, okay, why would it do that? And then start listening to music that was tuned to 432 hertz versus 440 hertz. When it's at 440 hertz, the music is very harsh. It's not smooth and inviting any longer. And all of the major composers, Bach, Beethoven, you know, they all tuned at 432 hertz to the middle A. Well, you have to wonder why this was pushed and who pushed it. And when you start researching who pushed this, it was Joseph Goebbels from the Nazi Party. And the agreement with the British Standards Institute was kind of pushed from the Rothschild to complete that transaction in 1939, just prior to the war. And the Nazis found that this was very important. It was paramount for them to see this change to standardized tuning. And we've continued that. And, you know,
And you think the ancients, they knew this?
I think the ancients knew this. And I think that it has somehow changed our whole psyche because we're listening to this harsh music.
It's not 4.32, is it?
No, it's not 4.32. It's at 440, and it's very harsh, and we can see a rise in aggression in our society. We can see a rise in fighting and, you know, deaths. And
you might be onto something because, you know, societies years ago listening to different kinds of music, slower music, I would say.
Whether it was slower music or faster music, it was still tuned.
It had a different sound to it.
Yes, definitely. And for those of you out in the audience, you know, go and listen to the difference between music that's tuned to 432 hertz and music that's tuned to 440 hertz. And it does sound quite a bit harsher. We don't understand what the full impact of that is yet at this time. But we do know that our own brains emit a frequency. And we are tuned to, I think it's like 7 hertz, something along that lines. And tunes and music has an effect on us. I mean, everybody in the world, or at least in the United States, rather, can very easily recite the ABCs. Why? Because we put it to song. We put it to music. If you want to learn something, you know, learn it to music. And that resonates with us. And even now, you try and go back through and do things alphabetically. How many adults are going A, B, C, D, E?
Well, I want you to look at something for us, Doug. Listen, with the blocks of the pyramids, for example.
Okay.
Let's say that they begin vibrating song or music at a block, a huge block. First of all, where does the sound come from? Is it a hum? Are they doing it? Where's it coming from?
Well, there's a lot of speculation on that. And I think a lot of it has to do with what was previously in the grand chambers there leading up to the king's chamber, okay, the cathedral part there in the inner passages of the Great Pyramid. There are discussions that would have held what they call Helmholtz resonators. And somehow they generated sound through those resonators. And there are other indications that there was water that was pumped into the bottom that gave a basic thump, thump, thumping on the bottom of the pyramid. Now, my question is not so much how did they generate the sounds. My question, and what my real interest is, what is resonating in concert, in harmony with the Great Pyramid when it's resonating.
Explain that.
Well, we've got these, you got the Great Pyramid, okay, and it's made with all of these, granite blocks, okay, high quartz content. When you chime that, when you hit that, it chimes, okay? Harmonic resonance is something that's resonating in tune with that note. And I would think that those obelisks that are standing all out around through the whole Egyptian culture were also resonating in tune with the pyramid and acting as a Tesla coil. And that's how they would have generated their electrical grid.
All right, so once this is happening, what happens to the block? Does it just float? I mean, are you familiar with Edward Leeds Scullin from Coral Castle?
Oh, yes.
Okay. He did the same thing. He knew what they did. I'm convinced of that.
I absolutely am convinced of that, too. One of the things that is reported about Edward and the Coral Castle was that he used these stones that look like ice cream cones in his hand to direct energy and move these giant blocks by himself. The man was only like 145 pounds, and here he was.
And by himself.
By himself, unloading these multi-ton blocks of coral. How was he able to do that? He was able to somehow rediscover this technology. And those stones that he had in his hand were in the shape of ice cream cones. And I think that definitely focused the sound energy towards those blocks. And when you have understanding of tones and what is in harmony and what is in discord, you're able to repel these blocks just like you would magnets, repelling each other. And that's how I think that they would have floated them.
The subtitle of your book, Harmonic War, says Guardians of the Crystal Skulls. Where do they come in?
Well, I like to play with numbers. And so throughout my book, I use numbers, and 13 happened to be one of the numbers that I wanted to use. When you look at the Bible, there's all kinds of hidden numbers throughout there. There's the number 3, the number 7, the number 12, multiples of 12, multiples of 7. And when I looked at when I started really researching things, I started seeing the number 13.
And aren't there 13 crystal skulls out there?
They're supposed to be the Mayan legend of the crystal skulls, which largely has been discounted as fake. But even so, there's still, one of the crystal skulls is in the Smithsonian Institute now. So they're very high-quality crystal skulls, and there's some mystical properties to them, reportedly. I wanted to use that because it follows the whole crystal theme that I like with, the high quartz crystal stones and harmonic resonance, and it just seemed to fit. But the number 13 also fit. Did you know that originally there were 13 zodiac signs?
I did not.
Yes, there were 13.
What happened to one of them?
It was changed to 12 sometime, I think, in 1300s or 1400s. I can't remember.
What did they dump?
That I don't know. We were on a trip in Italy, and we were going through one of the churches there. Strangely enough, they had the zodiac signs up there, and instead of 12 symbols, it was 13, and the guide pointed that out. See, there were originally 13 zodiacs, and I thought it was really strange that here in a Catholic church, here's the here's the zodiac signs and stuff, but clear as day, it was right there. So the number 13 started coming up, and then I started thinking about the apostles. Well, there were 12 apostles, but the group was 13. And that group maintained 13. Even after Jesus died, because Jesus would have been the 13th person, or the first person if you look at it that way. When he died and Judas committed suicide, the apostles, the remaining apostles, got back together and they elected Matthias to replace Judas. And then Jesus brought Paul in to maintain the number 13. I thought that was pretty cool. And so I used the 13 crystal skulls as a focal point.
Hmm.
And besides that, it was crystal, and I was like, yeah, that's it. I got to use it.
And you did.
So
now you talk about in your book, you kind of modeled good versus evil, too. I mean, that doesn't escape you, does it?
I like that, yeah. And it always makes for good stories, you know, wars and battles and, you know, conflict between forces of good and forces of evil. And in my book, you could probably describe the book itself best as Star Wars meets Game of Thrones without all the incest. So,
who wins, good or evil?
I've still got 3 more books to write on this one before we can find out who wins.
So there's no clear-cut winner yet.
There is no clear-cut winner yet. It's going to be a very, very close, tight battle, but it's going to be a very exciting one.
Did you have some kind of epiphany when you were writing this book?
I had quite a few. One of the things that really came to me was that, you know, I couldn't find better, you know, examples than to add angels and demons. And when I was adding one of the demons in the original writing, I was really in a very tense part of the book, and my computer crashed. I was like, oh, man, I can't believe this. You know, it's a MacBook Pro. It ought to be good. There should be no problem with it. But it died, and I couldn't bring it back. So I pulled a computer I had out of storage and started recreating everything that I'd saved, and I'd lost about 2 weeks' worth of work.
Oh, frustrating, isn't it?
It was, but, you know, it's like, okay, I had good outlines, and I knew where I was going to go, and I started recreating that that part of the story. And I got back to the same exact tense point, and the second computer died.
Huh.
And
like, omen, oh, there's an omen there.
Okay, all right, what's going on? I looked up and said, okay, God, what am I doing wrong here? And I went and talked to my pastor and, you know, shared with him what I was doing and, you know, where I was going.
And what were you doing at that exact moment? What were you writing about?
I was writing about the demon Legion.
Uh-huh, there you go.
And, you know, when you start invoking, you know, very powerful demons, you know, some strange things can happen.
You were like the human Ouija board. Doug, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back, talk more, and we'll take phone calls as we talk about his work, Harmonic Wars. We'll be back.